the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, and this morning we speak first with physics professor Adam Frank, along with philosophy professor Marcelo Gleiser, about what happens when science forgets or ignores the necessity of the human experience, especially because science rests on how we experience the world. They talk about this in their new book called The Blind Spot, Why Science Cannot Ignore Human Experience. Then we're joined by Rob Zellum, the exoplanet astronomer with NASA's Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. He'll tell us about the new Nancy Grace telescope and its mission, and how you can learn more from him at the Bryce Canyon National Park Astronomy Festival coming up in early June. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Since the dawn of enlightenment, humanity has looked to science to tell us who we are, where we come from, and where we're going. But we've gotten stuck thinking we know the universe from outside our position in it. However, science rests on how we experience the world. When science forgets or ignores the necessity of that experience, blind spots occur. Well, what if scientific knowledge became a narrative based on our lived experiences and the actual world around us? This is what our guests, Adam Frank, a professor of physics and astronomy, and Marcelo Gleiser, a professor of natural philosophy, along with Evan Thompson, a professor of philosophy, ask in their new book, The Blind Spot, Why Science Cannot Ignore Human Experience. Adam and Marcelo, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having us.
You say we must live in the world before we conceptualize it. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's the most basic thing we have, right? You have to exist, you have to be experiencing before you can start thinking about experiencing. You have to be present in the world before you can start asking questions and formulating approaches to explain what you experience. And that is basically the fundamental point we're making in the book, that often this metaphysics or philosophy we call the blind spot seeks to undercut that and thinks it can immediately go to this perspectiveless perspective.
Right. Well, Marcelo, let me ask you this. Why has the human experience and the scientific process separated themselves over the decades and eons?
Well, because science was so successful, right, from the beginning. So if you really go back, the origins of all this is from the 17th century with Galileo and Newton. And the questions they were asking about the world were questions which were very kind of experiential based. I mean, you looked, you saw the moon going around the earth. You saw the tides, you saw, you know, the stars, and with the telescope, Galileo saw the moons of Jupiter. And those were things that were very palpable and real in a sense. And so all the science that came from that, which is the mechanics, the law of gravity, all of that stuff was derived from this direct experience with the reality we could sense, right? And because of that, you start to extrapolate. And so as you advance in time and you go to the 18th and the 19th century, the mathematics of mechanics and of electromagnetic waves of light and stuff like that starts to become more and more powerful. And with that, more and more detached from our everyday experience, but still very efficient. And so people started to say, well, you know what? Maybe mathematics is sufficient to describe the world. We don't really need that much connection with the experience anymore, because look at what we've done. It's awesome, right? And that's where the troubles begin, right? When you start to push things beyond. So extrapolations, you know, it's kind of a funny thing, right? I mean, to invent the new, you must rely on the old. And that is just kind of a problem, right? Because how do you know the new if everything that you have to do starts what we know now? And so the problem with these equations is that they can be pushed in ways which are supposedly new, but they have nothing to do with the world that we live in. And so many kinds of extrapolations started to appear in, even in mechanics, in celestial mechanics. There was an issue with the orbit of the planet Mercury, you know, that astronomers knew about. And this guy, this French guy called Le Verrier, proposed the existence of another planet between the sun and Mercury called planet Vulcan. And people said, yes, I see planet Vulcan, you know, with our telescopes. And it was all wrong because nobody really saw it. But it took decades to figure that out. And why did Le Verrier trusted his extrapolation so much? Because the mechanics told him so. And that's where things get complicated.
Okay, the mechanics versus perhaps the human experience or human observation, maybe. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Adam Frank and Marcelo Gleiser. They, together with Evan Thompson, have written a new book called The Blind Spot, Why Science Cannot Ignore Human Experience. Adam, let's go to you. You know, what Marcelo is talking about made me think of, you know, when he talks about Galileo and Newton and, you know, back in the day, the scientists were the celebrities. The scientists were the people who everyone followed. And to that end, even today, we are still talking about them and everyone in this generation knows about them and Einstein. And yet it seems as though science has become that much more removed from our everyday lives. I don't know. Is that why the contemporary physicists are not becoming celebrities like the two of you? I mean, I know you have your own celebrity status, but could you comment?
I understand what you're saying. I think part of what has happened, and that one of the things we're pushing back on, is that particularly, I mean, this has happened across the sciences, but particularly in the domains that Marcelo and I work on, in physics and the cosmology and things, that there's been this ever expanding or ever rising cycle of abstraction, which has now reached the point where in things like string theory or the multiverse, where you have ideas that really are not grounded in observation at all. And yet, you know, enormous amounts of activity goes in the scientific community, goes on into them. And then it's we're told is that, you know, this is the pinnacle science. This is the, you know, science explaining the fundamental nature of reality. And what happens then is what something we call the surreptitious substitution. That's a line from the philosopher Husserl, where people start to substitute these extrapolations, these abstractions for experience, that somehow fundamental reality are these equations and not direct experience. And from that, I think, comes what you're talking about. Because these things are so removed, and we're talking about 10-dimensional, you know, universes that, again, there's no proof for it, and yet it's what's being talked about all the time, there becomes sort of a primary disconnect. And either you're somebody who's like super nerdy and you're really into following that science, or other people are like, I'm not really sure what this has to do with anything in my life. And that's even different from, you know, there's parts of cosmology which are very well grounded in data, like, you know, the evolution of galaxies. So I think what we're really pushing back against is this idea that somehow the abstractions are more real than the concrete. And the concrete is what we talk about presence or direct experience. And the only way really we're going to get to a fundamental reality is to include ourselves in it. We can't push ourselves away and say, oh, you know, it's an epiphenomena. We're just, you know, a sideshow to this fundamental reality, which has nothing to do with us.
Well, it's so interesting here on Cool Science Radio. For over a decade, we've been trying to bring science and technology to lay people. And we are lay people, curious lay people. And, you know, very often we ask the question when we're speaking to someone from NASA, or why does all this matter? Why should we care? And then they launch into this explanation about, like, you know, that cell phone that's in your pocket. Okay. Yeah. That's why you should care. But it does seem like there is a disconnect between, like you say, abstraction and what's concrete. And this is what you're trying to bring to the masses. And where do you want readers to emerge after having read your book or listened to this interview? You certainly don't want them to discard science, but what do you want them to do?
That's a super important question, because people may say, you know, these guys are just ditching science, you know, and saying this is not really that important, or they're wrong, or they don't know what they're talking about. And that is exactly not what we're doing. You know, if anything else, what we're trying to do with this book is restore the credibility of science. That is really the mission. Because once you start dancing in these stratospheric ideas, which are really far removed from what we can test right now. This is very important because then, you know, the blood of science is at the very end of the day is we need to test our hypothesis, right? We need to be able to make a difference. You know, this is okay, this has to do with our world, and this is not. And the way the discourse has been going is that those ideas of extra dimensions, of the multiverse, they need to be accepted. They are like, they have to be right, sort of thing. There was one guy that even said, if you don't want God, you must have the multiverse. So, which is a completely false dichotomy. You know, there is no such thing. And the problem with that is that creates not just the disconnect between the science that we're doing, which is indeed very far away from everyday people's reality, but a disconnect between the way scientists portray reality and the way reality really is. And so why should I believe these guys if this is true? And then 2 weeks from now, they're going to say, oh, this idea is wrong, or that idea is wrong. But wait, Stephen Hawking, or somebody said he solved the problem of the origin of the universe, you know? And we haven't, right? We can't, from basic principles of philosophy and stuff. So what we are worried about is that scientists, some scientists, sell science in a way they shouldn't be selling. And because it's based on extrapolations that we have absolutely zero reason to support at this point, right? So that's one point. The other point is that this does have the blind spot, as we say, is not just about physics, it's about consciousness, and it's about our planet. And so it has very direct consequences to how we live in this world, in nature, because once we put ourselves above nature through our minds, we are also putting ourselves above nature through our bodies, and we believe that we are above the natural world, and hence that the earth belongs to us and we can do whatever we want with it. And so there's a whole cascade of serious moral implications to this kind of positioning.
Well, Marcelo, to continue on this thread of thought, you think about the whole complexity of everything, and I think it's easy for everybody to get in their silos of just this topic or this field. But I look at it in terms of like the whole idea behind electric vehicles. And yes, they're a great idea, but these policies come out, these manufacturers come out, and they say, we're going to ban any sort of gas vehicle. We're going to make everybody buy electric vehicles. But in my mind, they're not really taking into consideration the whole picture, which is a massive blind spot. Like, one, where do we do all the charging stations? How does everyone afford a gas vehicle? How do people forget the commonality of people's needs and abilities to adhere to these new policies and scientific processes? How did that, was it lazy? Did they just forget? Do they not even, are they even not even trained on how to consider, you know, the typical person?
That's a good point. Do you want to take that on, Adam?
Well, I think complexity in general. So one of the things, you know, in the last chapter, so just to and also I just wanted to speak to that last, just something about that last question. What we're really addressing, because it's not just cosmology, as it's about what we understand life to be. Like, the blind spot says, oh, look, your life is a biological machine. That's all it is. It's just biological machinery. It says that cognition is just computing. It's just neural computations. It says consciousness is, yeah, again, it's just, you know, it's just the brain is all you need for. And everything we're pushing back on is this idea is that if you don't, you know, the question is not how to embed your experience or consciousness in physics. It's the other way around. How do you embed physics in experience? Experience comes first. And if you don't do that, you end up with people shoving AI technologies down your throat because it's going to make them zillions of dollars. And they're telling you like, oh, this AI machine is, it's going to be as smart as a human being. It's going to be sentient in 10 years. And there's just such a huge blind spot about what we are and what matters to us. And along those lines, in the last chapter, you know, we're not telling you what's coming after the blind spot. That's the next book or the next work. But we, in the last chapter, we do point to the idea of complexity science as something that has emerged in the last 50 years that sort of points to a different metaphysics, a different philosophy, because that's what the blind spot is. It's not science. It's a philosophy about science that's gotten tacked onto it, where people say, the philosophy says, oh, this is what science says. You're nothing but a meat computer, right? So there's another metaphysics waiting to emerge that comes out of something like complexity science that understands that, you know, there's no simple levers, that everything is a giant network of energy and information flowing backwards and forwards. And that is the way to, you know, understand the world, not as a simple machine that you just have levers on. And understanding that holism is the only way to, you know, when it comes to policy, when it comes to other things, understanding the holism of people embedded in the world and the effect that these policies have on them, to be able to create a thriving, sustainable, long-term human civilization where human beings, all human beings can thrive.
Adam, you bring up the idea of AI, not the idea, the fact of AI, and you've got a big section of your book devoted to it. Can AI fit into this holism? Because like you say, it's just looking at the individual parts. It doesn't know how to recognize life. It doesn't know how to design life. It doesn't understand the components of, or the, how it all fits together. So how does AI fit into this overarching sustainability of the human self?
Well, the problem with AI is not the AI itself. It's how it's being sold and how it's going to be jammed down our throats, because it's going to make some very rich people even richer. What we're really arguing, like the whole point of the, when we talk about AI, is that these misconceptions. Look, artificial intelligence is a tool. You know, the large language models are very powerful tools. They're great. It's only when people tell us, where we get no say in how these things get deployed, because we're told that, oh, look, these are machines that, you know, mimic what human beings can do. They are another kind of general artificial intelligence, or another kind of general intelligence like what we have. And they're nothing like us at all. They're the way, literally the way they're developed. They're, you know, in many sense, they're just stochastic parrots, as someone said. They are they're autocomplete on steroids. Not that they're not amazingly powerful, but because the people pushing this on us are telling us that, oh, this is a replacement for things that human beings do, we're going to end up building a society based on them. Just like now we're stuck with the versions of social media, enormously flawed social media that has utterly changed our culture. We're going to be stuck with these technologies and we're going to be trapped within them. And so what's going to happen is, because they're nothing like human beings, they're going to push us down. They're going to reduce our humanity to fit into their right angles, because they don't know how to do anything other than right angles.
So there is an alliance between science and power, and that happens throughout history. And those who have the most, let's say, cutting edge scientific tools are the ones that are going to have more power, the ones that are going to control the economy. And so AI is now that, right? So you have a race for that kind of power, because it is understood that just like computers change the world, those AI machines are going to also affect how we relate to one another. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to restore some level of humanity into this conversation, because we're saying, look, at the end of the day, we are not machines, and we are not going to become machines, at least not for a while, I hope. And we are going to be hopefully using those tools to improve the human condition. And the blind spot here is to try to reduce the human to a machine-like entity so that we can compare ourselves to those machines. But we are not like those machines. Our consciousness, our existence is completely embodied. You know, when people talk about brain in a vat, right, models of consciousness, whatever that thing could be, it will never be a human consciousness. And we have to just guard ourselves against that. And if we don't, you know, raise the red flags and make some noise about it, who is going to do it? Because a lot of the scientific community is being co-opted by those companies because there is money involved and there is power involved. You know, people that watched Oppenheimer saw very well what happens when very bright scientists create something new and extraordinary, but have no power to decide what to do with it, which is exactly what happened with nuclear technology and is exactly what's happening with AI right now. And that's our fear. So we're trying to restore this connection to the human by saying, look, first thing we do is we look at the world and then we do everything else.
It's really interesting what Adam was talking about with social media and the human experience. Maybe in some ways it was a precursor to what really matters, is AI being shoved down our throats, as you say. My question is, both of you are professors, so you deal with a lot of young people. And does there seem to be a revolution among young people who have been raised as digital natives, who are stepping away now and wanting to ask these bigger questions, stepping away from social media in some way, asking the bigger questions about AI, and not really accepting, like those of us who are maybe digital immigrants, you know, we don't know what to do and we don't know what to think. And yes, it's been foisted upon us, but oh goodness, and we're fearful and we buy into social media. What kind of revolution do you see, Marcelo?
So I actually teach a course. I am teaching it right now called Question Reality to the Dharma
students.
I read
about that. It sounds great.
And in that course, we ask these very questions, okay? It's not just about, oh, what is AI, but how is AI changing the world and how is AI changing your worldview, right? Because that's really what it's about. So I am basically forcing them to kind of reflect on how they are being changed by a technology that is literally being imposed on them, right? Because, you know, the more you use these technologies, the more your mindset changes. And you may be just carried away with that. And before you know it, you're not yourself anymore. You know, you are someone that depends on how people look at TikTok and see you. And your system of values is not yours anymore. And so I always try to bring back, even though I'm a physicist, I always try to bring back this more humanistic impact of what these scientific tools do to us as humans. And my experience with them is that they are very emotionally affected by this. So they are not fools. They are understanding that this is going on. And several of them have told me that they are abdicating social media as a way of communicating with other people. And I think the pandemic, in a sense, kind of helped with that a little, because they realized how social isolation is bad for your health and how you really need this kind of connection, you know, this relationship, which is brain and body connecting with brain and body, which is the essence of being human. And there is no machine in the world that will ever substitute for that. So The Blind Spot is just a cautionary book, you know, saying, look, be careful, because those blind spots could basically make you go into life without knowing where you're going.
Adam, do you want to add to that what you're seeing on your college campus?
Well, I'm seeing, it's funny because I was also just teaching, I was teaching an astrobiology course. And so one of the things was the search for life and the search for intelligent life. And the question of, like, once these digital technologies emerge for a civilization. So, you know, I'm an astrobiologist. I'm looking for, one of the things I do is, you know, the search for life in the universe. What happens? Like, you know, is there a way in which this is a pitfall for anyone? I've been teaching for almost 30 years now, and there is a profound change from this generation to the last generations of disconnect, of like, you know, I used to be able to go to my students and talk to them about, like, you know, what media they, you know, like Game of Thrones, we'd all talk about how much we love Game of Thrones or Star Wars. Didn't have to be something current. And now these kids, like, they're not watching anything. There's nothing shared. I just said, what are you guys watching? And they're like, oh, TikTok videos. The atomization of culture is something that I feel is really detrimental to these kids. And a lot of them knew it. And we talked a lot about the need to put the phones down. And I challenged them to, like, don't bring your phone tomorrow. I let them use no technology in class. So I think it's a real danger. We are really, what we've done to these kids, as I told them, it was kind of an experiment we ran on them. And I'm not sure it's working out so well. But this is why recognition of the blind spot and what these technologies are is so important. It's about, in the end, it's about, it's not just about science and the paradoxes that the blind spot foists on us in science. It's also about power and how, listen, science is so powerful. Any philosophy that claims to speak for science is going to make its way into the world. And when it comes to AI, you really see the detrimental effects of that.
Well, in the book, you talk about the perception of time. When they created the clock, all of a sudden time becomes this mechanized, measured element. Whereas humans, we had just gone through the world eons prior to that, just experiencing time differently. And now time, quote unquote time, which is the mechanized version, now dictates or tries to dictate how we go through our days, which doesn't seem right. So that's a blind spot that I've noticed. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's a very interesting thing. And it doesn't sound like science is going to catch up to the blind spots or even acknowledge them anytime soon. But how can we, as just humans existing in this technological world, how can we see the blind spots and either move around them or with them or even remediate them? I'm going to start with Marcelo. What do you think?
That's a good question. And as you're asking the question, I was thinking, how could we summarize what we've been discussing a little bit, which is not easy, right? And everything started from the distancing of cutting edge science from our everyday experience. Cutting edge in a more abstract sense, not about how to build a faster chip for your next computer, but, you know, can you unify the forces of nature? What happened before the Big Bang? What is life? That kind of, like. And so I think that there was a disenchantment that was created by this mechanization, this uber rationalization of reality, that made us forget true connection to the world, you know, that we are animals that evolved to be in the world, very present in the world, that this whole thing that we have invented that started 10,000 years ago with agrarian civilization, well, for the rest of our story in this world, 95% of the time or so, we were hunter-gatherers. We had a completely different relationship to the world, but we have isolated ourselves in such a way that we are now paying a price for it. And it's an emotional price, it's an existential price, it's a spiritual price. And I think, honestly, there is no silver bullet, there is no perfect way of solving the problem. But what I, as a very romantic kind of scientist, always say is that the first step that you can do in order to make sure you don't get drowned by all of this is to connect yourself deeper, as deep as you can, with the natural world. So go out, look at the sky, go out, be in the green and be in connection, direct connection with human beings, you know.
And their lives, I think, you know, Marcelo just hit the nail on the head. I'd say there's two things. The first one is go take a long walk in a park or in the woods. Like, I'm a big backpacker, you know, Marcelo's a long distance runner. Like, go spend not, you know, 20 minutes, but go spend like 5 hours, take a long walk and get out on a trail. Because after, like, for the first hour, your mind's just like, yada, yada, yada. But then after like the second hour, suddenly you get into this very different space. You know, I love the idea people are taking forest baths. Like, that seems to be a little too explicit for me, but the idea is right. Get out there, you know, and after 2 hours, you don't need to have anybody remind you that you're an animal. You'll know you're an animal because the body remembers. So that's one thing. And you know, what's interesting is if you want to like connect this to science, bring a notebook. Be a naturalist. That's what naturalists did. Scientists started with people at awe in the woods with a notebook, drawing the leaf, counting how many of that mushrooms there were around that tree. You know, you can also think about it as well while you're also experiencing it.
And that was astronomy professor Adam Frank, along with philosophy professor Marcelo Gleiser. Their book is The Blind Spot, Why Science Cannot Ignore Human Experience.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
It's that time of year again when stargazers will descend on Bryce Canyon National Park for the annual Astronomy Festival. The festival offers so much more than guided discoveries of the night sky. The Salt Lake Astronomical Society and the University of Utah bring their telescopes to share with attendees. There are daytime activities that include solar telescopes, along with evening programs with national experts and scientists discussing the night sky and the latest discoveries and explorations. One such expert who will be in Bryce is Rob Zellum, exoplanet astronomer with NASA's Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. Rob, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to being out in Bryce Canyon.
Well, before the show, Lynn and I were talking that we haven't heard of the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. What is that?
Yeah, so the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope is NASA's next flagship mission that'll be launching no later than May of 2027. Really excited, as this will be the sort of the next generation space telescope that'll be doing general astronomy for the entire astronomical community.
And so you are an exoplanet astronomer. What is your role with the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope?
So I'm the communications scientist for the Roman Space Telescope. And my own science, what I do is I study exoplanets. These are planets outside of our own solar system. And what I'm interested in doing scientifically myself is trying to characterize what these planets are made up of. And I'm excited to work on the Roman Space Telescope, both on the science communication side, but also the scientific side, because the Roman Space Telescope will be discovering tens of thousands of exoplanets, planets outside of our own solar system. And it will also be demonstrating technology to help us eventually, hopefully, discover a planet that might have life on it. So while the Roman Space Telescope will not enable us to look at Earth-like planets, the technology that it'll be demonstrating today, or in the very soon future, will then be applying it to the next generation of NASA missions to hopefully start looking for and characterizing Earth-like planets.
Wow, that's exciting. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Rob Zellum. He is involved with NASA's Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, due to launch no later than May 2027.
Rob, we've been so taken with, I mean, first it was Hubble, and then more recently, of course, James Webb Space Telescope. But I understand that the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope will be able to see like 100 times bigger sort of area than Hubble Space Telescope. But can you make some comparisons with James Webb? Because that's what we've been seeing recently, right? The first photos that have come back.
Yeah, so the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope is sort of a successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. It actually has a very similar, if not the same, mirror size as Hubble, but it has a much larger field of view. So it can see more objects at a single time. So its field of view is actually akin to the size of a full moon. And this enables Roman to do science more quickly than the Hubble Space Telescope, over 1,000 times faster than Hubble. And the way this sort of interacts or fits in with the James Webb Space Telescope is the way I like to think about it is that James Webb is giving us this really high precision, very detailed little snapshots on a smaller field of view of the universe. And then Roman, with its much larger field of view, will give us that sort of larger context for the James Webb's observations. They really do work hand in hand. So for example, we might get some observations with James Webb that we want a broader context of later on with Roman, or vice versa. We might take some Roman images that we'll want to look at more in depth and detail with James Webb. So I'm really looking forward, honestly, to these two telescopes working in tandem and really keying off of each other to get us a better understanding of the universe.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. And, you know, tying this all back into the Bryce Astronomy Festival, I'm picturing the Roman telescope as being something that feels more like a huge, big, bright night sky in southern Utah, where it's very dark and such a wonderful place to view the night sky. Now, I know you did your PhD in Arizona, so I'm thinking similar night sky where hopefully you're out and you're able to see with the dry air, really get a great view of the night sky. Have you been to the Bryce Astronomy Festival before?
I've never been out to Bryce Canyon ever before, so I'm really looking forward to it. I definitely miss those dark skies that I was very much spoiled with outside in Tucson, Arizona, and I'm looking forward to seeing the Milky Way again for sure, and really excited to meet tons of amateur astronomers and stargazers. Absolutely looking forward to it, and just so excited to come out there.
So, Rob, I know that you're part of it. I'm assuming you're part of a team from the Roman Space Telescope going to the Bryce Astronomy Festival. You can't bring the Roman telescope with you, unfortunately, but what will you be doing at the festival?
So at the festival, we'll be talking with members of the public and answering all of your questions that you might have about this amazing telescope. And for your time and patience with hearing all my horrible dad jokes and puns, we'll be giving you lots of fun handouts like Roman stickers and paper products. And we'll also have a model of the Roman Space Telescope as well. And we can talk you through the two main instruments on board. And also we'll be talking about Nancy Grace Roman herself. So she was NASA's first chief astronomer. She's sometimes called the mother of the Hubble Space Telescope because she was really one of the main proponents of getting Hubble launched. And in her honor, we've named the Roman Space Telescope after her. Really excited talk about both the space telescope and also the person that inspired Roman as well.
Yeah, I was reading a bit about her, and she's called the pioneer of modern space-based astronomy. And this is the first time I've ever heard of her, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners haven't heard of her before and until now. How big is this team for this telescope? It's, you know, you're looking for exoplanets, but what else will the Roman telescope be looking for?
So the Roman Space Telescope, there's honestly hundreds, if not thousands of people involved in this mission. There are two major instruments on board, the wide field imager. So that's that camera that can take images roughly the size of the full moon, and the coronagraph instrument as well, which will be directly imaging exoplanets. That's its main science goal, and also disks around stars as well. Really, the observatory as a whole will be a general astronomy mission for the entire astronomical community. So we'll be doing everything from cosmology, like dark matter, dark energy, to exoplanets, to discovering planets by the thousands. And all of our data will be nearly immediately public within 24 to 48 hours, which is really something that we're all very passionate about. So you can sort of think about this as this mission is sort of democratizing science in the sense that all of the data will be public to anyone to use, not just scientists, but also those who might be listening in today. If you want to look at some cool Roman imagery of like maybe the Andromeda galaxy, if Roman points that way, or the Horsehead Nebula, that would be amazing to see as well. you can actually download those images and analyze them yourself and make your own cool space images relatively quickly as well.
Rob, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more. And Nancy Grace Roman, you know, the mother of the Hubble Space Telescope, it's really incredible who she is and what she accomplished, especially at a time she was born in 1925. And I'm sure that was a time where there, well, when she came into the field, there weren't many female scientists at all, let alone astronomers. Tell us a little bit more about her.
It's pretty incredible what she was able to achieve given the times. You know, she was the first chief astronomer of NASA, definitely in a time that was very male dominated. And she was such a great person about reaching out not only to the scientific communities, but also the general public as well. So back in the day, folks thought that launching space telescopes wasn't necessarily a great endeavor. We had all these amazing telescopes on the ground that are doing impactful science. So why, you know, spend the time and the energy and the budget to launch something up into space? So really honored to be the communications scientist for Roman and the mission, because I sort of feel like I'm sort of following in her footsteps of having to both be able to talk to the scientific community to get those folks excited about the science and the mission itself, but also to share my love of astronomy with the general public and to really just get folks excited about all the amazing work that will be upcoming right around the corner, honestly. And through all of Nancy Grace Roman's efforts, she was able to convince NASA and the general scientific community that spending all this time, this money, this effort on getting space telescopes launched was a worthwhile endeavor. And eventually that paid off in the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope, which has been doing such amazing, impactful science. And when I was a kid, I was inspired to become an astronomer by looking at Hubble imagery myself. The ability that I could potentially inspire the next generation by helping share this amazing imagery coming out of Roman is just a dream come true and just totally mind-blowing to me as well. So really excited.
Well, it's really great to hear the way that you can talk about it. And as we always say on Cool Science Radio, the really important thing is to be able to talk about science, not just do it, but talk about it so that the lay people out there can also get excited. The young people, like you say, you know, how you were inspired as a young person by Hubble Space Telescope photos. So Nancy Grace Roman died at the age of 93, and that was in 2018, not too long ago. Did she know that there was this telescope that was going to be named after her before her death?
No, unfortunately, it was named after her death, but she was able to visit Goddard, and there's actually a really cool photo of her standing in front of the James Webb Space Telescope when it was at Goddard being tested. And now that photo is actually hung outside the clean room where that photo was taken a few years ago. While she didn't, unfortunately, wasn't around to find out that Roman was going to be named after her, it's still a huge honor, and we're really all extremely happy that it was named after her on the team for sure.
She sounds like an amazing person. Well, Rob, let's go back to the exoplanet discussion. Why study exoplanets? So much attention goes towards stars and galaxies and supernova, but what do exoplanets teach us?
Honestly, I'm just a giant Star Wars nerd, and I want to ride the Millennium Falcon one day. In order to do so, I have to figure out where it's docked, right? So ultimately, what's really driving me at the end of the day is how do we find life out there in the galaxy? So in order to find life, we have to first find planets that could host life on their surface. So that's what's always driving me, is trying to help be part of the process that discovers a planet that could potentially be habitable. And Roman actually will be studying exoplanets using a variety of methods that will help us learn a lot more about planet demographics, how often they form, what type of planets that form at all. So if we have mostly big hot planets or small cool temperate planets, what sort of stars they form around. And also we can start taking images of exoplanets as well. So the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope will actually be focusing more so on doing a lot of different exoplanet science. For example, it'll be on the WFI, the Wide Field Imager, it'll be studying thousands of planets using the microlensing technique and the transiting planet technique. And on the coronagraph side, we'll be using the instrument to take direct images or snapshots of these exoplanets as well. And sort of in concert, these will sort of help move the goalposts to achieving a better understanding of planets, how often planets form, how likely Earth-like planets are to form, maybe, but then generally enough technology to help us get to the next generation of space telescopes to study them.
Well, I was reading that the Roman telescope will be out at the L2 position, which is basically a million miles away, the same basic distance from Earth as the James Webb Space Telescope. But also, that seems to me that it's going to give it a much better chance of finding exoplanets because it is so far away. But I was also reading about rogue planets and how Roman was going to be searching for rogue planets and that there's 20 times more rogue planets than stars. Do we need to worry about these rogue planets? Could that be the planet X that everyone keeps talking about?
Yeah, so luckily there's a ton of empty space in between every single astronomical object. So the likelihood of any collision happening with the Earth is very, very, very slim, very astronomically slim, to use a horrible pun there. But yeah, you bring up a great point of Roman being out at L2 of the second Lagrange point, just beyond the orbit of the moon where James Webb is currently parked. And we've selected that orbit because it's very stable in terms of the thermal balance in order to also get light on its solar panels to power up the telescope. But also, unlike the Hubble Space Telescope, which is in low Earth orbit, where Hubble orbits around the Earth every 90 minutes, roughly half of Hubble's orbit, it can't be observing because the sun gets in the way. Whereas at L2, we have better access to about half the sky at any given time. And thanks to that orbit, we'll be able to stare at patches of the sky for a longer period of time. And programs that'll be taking advantage of this is the microlensing campaign that'll be basically using relativity to help us find planets around distant stars. And in that, we can also potentially find these rogue planets, planets that likely formed around stars, but then over their formation, maybe due to gravitational interaction with a nearby star, they are kicked out of their solar system, and now they're sort of free floating out there in the galaxy. And perhaps Roman, through its microlensing campaign, will help us discover these rogue planets just sort of free floating out there.
Wow, that sounds so cool. So you will be at the Bryce Astronomy Festival. The festival's taking place Wednesday, June 5th through Saturday, June 8th. And really there's a keynote program taking place on Saturday, and that involves one of your colleagues, NASA scientist, Dr. Julie McHenry. And she will be presenting the keynote program at 9 p.m. on Saturday. It's a 45-minute program. Boy, you really have to practice staying up late because, of course, they have the telescopes up until midnight so you can see the night sky. What can you tell us about her talk and a little bit about her?
Yeah, so Julie McHenry is the senior project scientist for the Roman Space Telescope. She is the person basically in charge at the end of the day for ensuring that Roman is a success. And she'll be giving an overview talk of all the incredible science and the technology that the Roman Space Telescope will be launching. Her talks are absolutely amazing. She will be giving all the details on dark energy and dark matter and exoplanets, and should be extremely exciting. Also, some sort of simulated images that we expect that Roman will be able to capture once it does launch in just a few years. At her talk, you'll be able to hear about all the amazing science and technology that Roman will be doing. And also, you can come up and talk to her and ask questions, I'm sure, afterwards. But also, you can come and talk to us at the Roman table that we'll be staffing all throughout the entire festival. So you'll be busy. Make sure to bring lots of caffeine, coffee, sodas to stay awake, because I'm going to need it myself.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, this is taking place on Saturday, June 8th at 9 p.m. It's about a 45-minute program with Dr. Julie McHenry. And I think it's sort of fitting and wonderful that she is also a female and a very accomplished scientist, NASA scientist, just like NASA scientist Nancy Grace Roman, who the Roman Space Telescope is named for. I love that. I don't know if that was done purposefully or not, but it's a nice touch.
And Julie is a very accomplished scientist in her own right. So she was the project scientist for the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope and has her own PhD in astronomy as well, and experimental physics, actually. And super accomplished and great public speaker. So it should be a really amazing program for sure.
Rob, I hope you get to go out there for more than just your presentation. What are you excited about to see and do at the Bryce Canyon Astronomy Festival?
Well, first and foremost, it'll be my first ever visit to Bryce Canyon, so I've heard so much about, and I'm ashamed to say that I haven't visited, despite me living in the Southwest for so many years during my PhD. So I'm really excited about seeing the park first and foremost. but also just talking with folks and sharing my love of astronomy and my excitement for this next NASA flagship mission with the general public, and also interacting with more amateur astronomers and stargazers. That was also one of the reasons I became an astronomer myself, is interacting with the amateur astronomy community and just sort of feeding off their excitement and all the amazing things they've been able to do with their own telescopes. Just really looking forward to talking and meeting folks as well.
So Rob, I was reading that the Roman Telescope will be launched on a SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket. It's great to see these public-private partnerships coming together. What other organizations are involved with the Roman Telescope besides just JPL, who you work with, and SpaceX?
So the mission is being managed by the Goddard Space Flight Center out here in Greenbelt, Maryland, and that's one of the NASA centers. There's also larger international participation with the European Space Agency. There's folks at the Japanese Space Agency called JAXA. So it not only is a NASA mission that involves many different NASA centers, from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory out in Los Angeles, California, to NASA Goddard out in Maryland, but also an international community as well. And this is really honestly reflective of how this is truly a space mission that is for the entire astronomical community, and just why it makes me even more excited and honored to be working on it, quite honestly.
Again, back to the exoplanet idea. I'm just fascinated with them. So many times when we hear discoveries or theoretical discoveries of an exoplanet, they think it's a big gaseous planet like a Jupiter or a Saturn. But could someone, let's say that, you know, there's another telescope from some faraway distance galaxy looking towards our sun, would a planet the size of Earth be picked up? Because it seems like those are the planets that we really want to find.
Yeah. And the reason that we're mostly finding these big gassy planets is simply because they're just a lot easier to see. The bigger the planet, the bigger the signal it is, and therefore the easier it is to find. But as you noted, what we really want to get down to eventually are small Earth-like planets. Planets that are roughly the size of the Earth, that are roughly in the same orbital distance around their star that is hopefully like our own sun. So you have the right temperature on the surface of that planet for water to form and survive. And perhaps with water, there might also come life. So the Roman Space Telescope likely will not have the precision necessary to observe these Earth-like planets. This is probably something that will be needed for the next generation of space telescopes, such as in the 2030s or the 2040s. But perhaps when those next telescopes start coming online and use the technology that has been demonstrated, hopefully successfully, by Roman, we'll be able to finally answer those questions. You know, how common are Earth-like planets? And perhaps are we able to see signatures of life in their atmosphere or their planetary signal? And perhaps maybe there is a planet out there that has life on its surface that might be 20 to 30 years ahead of us. And they've already launched their next great space telescope, and maybe they're observing us today. That would be pretty incredible. And that's honestly what keeps me up at night. Whenever I walk my dog at night and look up the stars, perhaps there's another alien species looking back at us, wondering with their alien dogs if we exist as well.
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, Rob, you know, you talked about how, and we know this from the fact that during the development of the James Webb Space Telescope, some of it was built here in Utah. So we watched that. These projects go, as you said, from coast to coast, from JPL in Pasadena to NASA Goddard in Greenbelt, Maryland, you know, here in Utah. And these projects are big and they're widespread. And we concentrate so much on what we're doing with NASA because we're here in America and we're Americans and we're proud of NASA, right? But what are the other space telescopes around the world that are providing some really groundbreaking information? I guess I'm not really familiar with them.
Yeah, and just thinking also about Roman, we have many partners at universities as well that might, folks that might not be at a NASA center. So it truly is a stretching across a wide swath of folks across the entire United States. And also, as I mentioned a little earlier, internationally. And that seems to be mostly how a lot of these larger space missions are going. It's really in our best interest to include, at least in my own opinion, our international partners, because they can lend their expertise, whether that's technology or science, to help us make that mission a success. So for example, for the James Webb Space Telescope, the European Space Agency provided the launch vehicle to getting James Webb up into space, which not only saved NASA a ton of money, which was great, but also ESA provided their technological and scientific expertise and are helping currently making James Webb a giant success. And similarly, ESA participated extensively in the Hubble Space Telescope mission as well. So a lot of these larger space telescope missions do feature not only very many different folks across the United States, but also the world as well. And honestly, that just makes the mission better because you can rely on folks that can bring their own unique and different perspectives to helping ensure that you get mission success at the end of the day.
Our guest has been Rob Zellum. We are looking forward to seeing you, Rob, at the Bryce Canyon Astronomy Festival. That's June 5th through 8th, Wednesday through Saturday. What day will you actually get there?
I think I'll be there the entire time staffing the table. So please come up and grab some of our stuff so we don't have to lug it back across the country. And I'll be there. Yep. Happy to chat with folks about Roman and space telescopes or exoplanets or really anything general astronomy. And hopefully get to meet some amateur astronomers and look at their amazing setups and take a look at some celestial objects through those too.
Well, I know Lynn and I are hoping to get out there, so hopefully you'll get a chance to meet some amateur science radio hosts. Well, Rob, thank you again. We will post links to the Roman Space Telescope on our website and hopefully see you in June at Bryce.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to chatting with you too in person. Appreciate it.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.